I was thinking of asking the worship team to do a Christmas carol for us today, but I don't know. Thought that might be a little jarring for some people. I won't mention Steve's name, but it would be a little traumatizing for some. We are, though, just 30 Sundays away from Christmas. Now, that might instill fear in the heart of some of you or desire in the soul of others, like Ethan, yes. But today we're looking at the Christmas story. I didn't even realize there was a Christmas story embedded in Revelation until I started studying Revelation. I mean, I've read it, but never pictured it. Oh, that is the Christmas story. So if you've been tracking with us, you're going to guess that this Christmas story is going to be a little bit different. Not quite the ones we hear in the Gospels. It may be wacky, it may be probably violent. Definitely won't look like this. You know, Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus, the shepherds, the magi, the whole lot singing away in a manger, no crying he makes, except there's a drummer boy, right, playing, and then kids laying in the hay, so I'm sure he's crying. But won't look like that if it's in Revelation. We think we know the story. It's central to our faith. We hear it every year. God took on our flesh, came as one of us, and one of the lowliest of us, doing life on earth, experiencing all the things, the love of family and friends, celebrations, good food, pain, loss, discomfort, constipation, sore feet, jealous siblings, gossipy neighbors, sweaty armpits, grumpy people, dippy disciples, self-righteous and judgmental religious people. Sure, I know for sure. Many of you here have experienced that. But all of the things Jesus experienced, God experienced in the flesh of Jesus. And then finally, the gravest of injustices when he experienced a violent death, a public state execution, a crucifixion of all things at the hands of the religious establishment and the Roman government. We could say at the hands of church and state. And in all of it, Jesus showed us the path of love, mercy, forgiveness. And by all of it, Jesus showed us the face of God, the heart of God, the mission of God to bring all, everyone, into a place of belonging, of oneness, of unity with creation, with our Creator, with one another, to experience life as God intends it. Flourishing, the healing, the abundance. We say around here at Lakeside, if you want to know what God is like, look no further than Jesus. God looks like Jesus, always has, always will. And that's the heart of God for us, friends, for all of creation. The Bible is a story from start to finish of how we've mucked it all up. And how God continues to pursue us and forgive us and invite us back into the party, back home, you could say, into God's presence. And so that's the Christmas story as we know it. But it's not the whole story. You see, behind the twinkly lights and the Hallmark nostalgia, something else is going on, something really sinister. Last week, I said, we look at life as though we are looking up from underwater. That's what a boat looks like, from underwater. If you're Nemo, that's what a boat looks like. And that's how we see the Christmas story. We see it as those who are looking up from below. But Revelation shows us life from what it looks like from above. It shows us the Christmas story from God's perspective, behind the scenes, when we pull back the curtain of the material reality that our senses can experience. We're in week 5 of Revelation, so I'm not going to recap it, but if this is your first Sunday with us in Revelation, I encourage you to go back and just listen even to the first one, to the introduction, kind of gives you the lay of the land of what to expect as we come into this kind of crazy book. But here are some main things to keep in mind for today, but as we go forward. Revelation is a vision. That means it's like a dream. And we know how wacky dreams can be, right? How out of order they can be. But often they tell us something. They give us a message. They reveal our fears, our hidden anxieties. And they don't usually make logical sense when we wake up in the morning and we try to retell it. But it carried a message. So Revelation is like that. It is a vision. Revelation's full of symbols. And symbols we know contain entire stories and belief systems. The Canadian flag. If you are a refugee and you have fled a war-torn country and you've left everything behind and you disembark the plane and you walk into the terminal and you've been waiting for this day and you see the Canadian flag, that for you is safety and security and a new future and hope. If you've lived here your whole life and your family generations go back and back and back, maybe that flag has a lot of nostalgia for you. If you're Indigenous, it's probably really complicated to look at that flag. There's generations of trauma hiding behind that flag. So we have to understand symbols if we're going to understand Revelation. Revelation isn't linear or chronological. It goes in circles. It's repetitious. We can't get a timeline out of Revelation. If we try, we just lose our minds because it's totally illogical. So Revelation is a vision, like dreams. It's full of symbols. It's not linear or chronological. And tons of numbers. Lots of numbers in Revelation, but the numbers aren't really numbers. They're symbols. 3 is perfection. It represents God. 4 represents the earth. 7 is completion or totality. 10 means unending. 12 represents the Jewish people as well as all Jesus followers. And 1,000, well, 1,000 is so many. It's just a number thrown out there for like so many. And Revelation is an apocalypse. And an apocalypse means revealing, unveiling. So when you hear the word revelation, think revealing. Don't think catastrophe. It's revealing what is hidden, and specifically the revelation of Jesus. And we read it like we would read Lord of the Rings or Narnia. It's fantastical. It's true. It's just not literal. And so in Revelation's version of the Christmas story, it is perhaps the most accurate version, although I don't know if accurate's the right word. Maybe it's the most revealing version of the Christmas story. We need to pay attention to the symbols, to the numbers, and to remember it's a vision. It's true, it's not literal. It's basically a commentary on what's happening around the birth of Jesus. What's going on in the spiritual realm at Jesus' birth, behind all the twinkly lights and the away in the manger. So here we go. An apocalyptic Christmas. Are you ready? You sure? Because it really might mess with your Christmas forever. Revelation 12, verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven. Now, this is the first time John uses this phrase, and it's loaded. If you were watching this as a movie, this is where the soundtrack would get really, really ominous, and you'd just know that someone's hiding around the corner. This is where Robin closes her eyes and ears. Steve, tell me when it's over. Something huge is about to happen here. Something's about to be revealed, unmasked, exposed. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. It's clearly special. She's kind of somewhat divine. This has cosmic significance. Whenever we see the sun and the moon and all the things in Scripture, we know that this has cosmic implications. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth, and that is an understatement. She's actually symbolic of Israel. The 12 stars on her head represents the Jewish people. And she's giving birth in pain. And Israel was often represented in their scriptures as giving birth in pain. So here John's setting up a direct contrast between Rome's propaganda, who had a goddess. And guess what? She was radiant like the sun and her feet were on the moon. She represented the hope of the world. Rome claimed to be the hope of the world, the peace of the world. So that's the one vision. That's Rome's vision. That's Rome's propaganda. And here we have in John's vision something very, very similar. A woman radiant like the sun with her feet on the moon giving birth. And then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon. We know from last week red represents blood, with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns on its head. Its tail swept a third of the stars. Stars were symbolic of angels. Swept it out of the sky and flung them to earth. So, we know that red equals blood. This is a figure of a bloodthirsty evil presence. And this dragon-like force of evil has seven heads. Now that might represent the seven kingdoms who had conquered Israel through the centuries. Or we know numbers aren't numbers. Seven is totality. This could be the totality of grotesqueness of this monster, this dragon. 10 horns. 10 is unending. Horns represent power. Unending power. 10 crowns. 10 is unending. Crowns are authority. Unending authority. Now, if you try to imagine 7 heads with 10 horns and 10 crowns, it's just going to break your brain. This is how we know we are in the world of symbolism, because it just doesn't even make sense. But the message is the dragon is not to be messed with, not to be taken lightly or dismissed. This is a serious threat. John is trying to convey this is a sinister power at work behind the silent night. John is exposing, unveiling, unmasking this face of evil that's often hidden, often skulking in the shadows, masquerading as something to be admired. We're going to see that next week. We're going to see it in all of its grotesqueness and ugliness. This is an image for John's audience that spells doom. And so that's the dragon. But there's another huge clue here, and it's hidden in plain sight. It's the mention of wiping out a third of the stars. Now, why a third? It kind of seems insignificant, but it's important, and I just want to park here for 2 seconds, because this is a key. It's a key to understanding the violence of Revelation that we often attribute to God. By the way, it's the third time the stars have fallen from the sky, so again, we know this isn't literal. This is the land of symbolism. But there are thirds throughout Revelation. A third of the earth burned up. A third of the stars fell 3 times. A third of the sun was struck. A third of the moon was struck. A third of the day went without light. A third of the night was without light. I thought that was the point of night, was to be without light. But apparently a third of the night was without light. So we see thirds everywhere. And once you see it, you can't not see it. And remember, numbers aren't numbers in Revelation. They're signs, they're symbols. And here what we have is a signature of evil. If 3 is the number of perfection, 1/3 is its reversal. If 3 is the number for God, 1/3 is a God wannabe. Think of it like a signature left by a computer virus or malware. Or your own signature that identifies that document, that check, whatever, as yours. Or fingerprints that a criminal leaves behind. A third is the fingerprint of the dragon, of evil intelligence. And once you see it, again, you can't unsee it. Sigve Tonstad's a remarkable scholar on Revelation. He said this, a third is not a reference to quantity. Instead, a third is a marker of agency. Who done it? And it answers the question, who? Who's behind the violence? The dragon's signature, the dragon's fingerprints are all over Revelation, all over the destruction and the violence. And when we know that, it changes how we look at Revelation. It changes our image of God in Revelation. John's basically singing with the 5-man electric band, sign, sign, everywhere a sign. Can't you read the sign? He's giving it for us. And when we realize that, we see who the real agent of violence is. It's not God or the Lamb. And the Lamb, as we remember, is the sign, symbol, represents Jesus. Being able to discern the signature of evil versus the signature of God is crucial for Jesus followers because evil is so deceptive. As a matter of fact, throughout Scripture, the evil presence is often referred to as the deceiver, masquerading as good, impersonating God. And if we come to Revelation expecting a God who is capable of horrific violence, we're going to find it. But if we come to Revelation knowing that Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever and understanding the symbolism and the context and what John's audience would have heard, we see a whole different story. And this is why it's so important. This is why we continually drive home culture, history, language, symbolism. If we don't understand it, we miss it. Not just here, but maybe especially here. So back to Christmas. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. Now that's the view. The view from the below is Mary in the stable. The view from above is evil wanting to devour Christ. And Jesus was hunted by this dragon, by this evil presence throughout his entire life. Then it says, she gave birth to a son. That is word for word the Christmas story we find in Luke. A male child who will rule all the nations. In other words, the whole world. John gives us a spoiler alert to the end of the story. How? How is this person going to rule? With an iron scepter. Again, if we don't know the symbolism, that sounds kind of brutal. It's hard to imagine Jesus with an iron scepter. But an iron scepter in the ancient Near East was a symbol of divine authority. When kings were established on their throne during coronation ceremonies, we find this in the Psalms. It talks about them having an iron scepter, ruling with an iron scepter. In other words, ruling with the authority of God. They have that kind of authority. They can do whatever they want. They can exact vengeance. They can slaughter enemies. They can be as benevolent as they want because they have the blessing of God. But John's subverting this imagery. And all through Revelation, things are not what they seem. That's how we have to come to Revelation, with suspicion. Things are not as they seem. Because who's on the throne? The living, slaughtered Lamb. That's who's ruling. And the Lamb's way of conquering is self-giving love. And what is his scepter? The cross. The cross is how God rules. The cross is how God wins. Lock that in, friends. I feel like the church has lost sight of that over the past number of centuries. The scepter is the cross. The way God rules is the cross. The way God wins is the cross. The way we live and follow Jesus is the cross. Continuing, John says, and her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. Well, that's an image of the resurrection and Jesus' ascension. But here's a really kind of funny, ironic thing for those of you who are, you know, tracked with Left Behind. The word snatched up is actually the word rapture. So Jesus is the only one raptured in Revelation, but we'll get to that in a couple of weeks. The woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. Remember, this is a vision. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. This is like the 140-character message explaining the origins of evil on the earth. Just like that. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent. Underline that. Ancient serpent. Called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Full disclosure, John believes in a primordial force of evil, a supernatural force of evil. Scripture teaches the existence of a primordial force of evil, a supernatural force of evil. This vision gives face to a primordial force of evil. It's very real, it's very present. And it's very dangerous. John gives this evil force, this dragon, many names. Ancient serpent, devil would be the Greek word for it. Satan would be the Hebrew word for it. And by weaving all these titles together, titles that would have been very familiar to John's audience, John is making a really bold point. Because regardless of what we call it, regardless of how we imagine it, it's real. And it's this enduring evil intelligence that permeates the earth, that's opposed to God and opposed to God's creation. And the names may change throughout cultures and languages and civilizations and generations, but the reality behind them remains the same. There is a destructive force that is warring against God's good creation and God himself, working against God's purposes. Right from the beginning. So don't be put off by the names. If you've been in church most of your life, this isn't news. But what might be news is how evil shows up and the places it hides and the masks it wears. Masks that we've become used to. Maybe masks that we even look at and admire, that we think are good. And we're going to explore that next week. It's going to be on full display in all of its gross ugliness. John pulls no punches. And for some, this evil intelligence is an agent, a personality, like the devil, as represented in Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. For others, it's not really a personality, it's just systems and structures that are sort of infected with some kind of an evil type, you know, virus or malware. And still others, maybe some of you, just think it's all phooey. There's no evil presence. And I get it, because any picture or image that we have of evil or of an evil being is mythological. It's representative. It's a human concept of what we imagine evil to look like. But here's the thing. We all know evil is real. And so while we may reject the caricatures of Satan and the devil, I want to encourage you not to dismiss the concept of evil as a real evil intelligence or force at work. Canadian Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, he led the U.S. peacekeeping mission in Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. He said this, "I know there's a God, because in Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil. I have seen him, I have smelled him, and I have touched him. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." In the letter to one of the churches, the Apostle Peter wrote, he said, "Discipline yourselves, stay alert. Like a roaring lion, your adversary, your enemy, the devil, prowls around looking for someone to devour." He's trying to get his church, to get the audience to not be so complacent, to be aware. So the dragon's hurled to earth. So what? Verse 10, John continues, "Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, 'Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah.'" Spoiler alert. It's the end of the story right here. God wins. And throughout Revelation, throughout all what looks like judgments and violence and destruction, we see these spoiler alerts. God wins, friends. God wins. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well, but in the meantime. "For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, who has been hurled down, they triumphed over him." That is, they defeated him. How? How? "By the blood of the Lamb." Again, this is how God wins, not by force and conquest. "And by the word of their testimony," not by force and conquest. "They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death." AKA, they were martyred. They were killed for following the Lamb. And then he goes on, "When the dragon saw that he'd been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time." Again, that's a number. "Out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth, the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus." That's a lot. Remember, it's like Game of Thrones. It's like Lord of the Rings, right? It's a vision. But that's a lot. Merry Christmas. It's not likely that'll be on Christmas cards anytime soon, although it might be a business opportunity for somebody. But this was the spiritual reality. While away in a manger is going on down here, this is going on in the heavenlies. This is the story behind Christmas. When we peel back the curtain of the physical world. And while Mary's giving birth to Jesus and laying him in a manger, the murderous forces of evil are gathering to devour this child, this Savior. God's plan for the restoration of the world, God's plan that's in the scroll that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. This is behind the scenes of Silent Night, and there's nothing silent about it in the heavenlies. The view from down here is King Herod hunts for Jesus. Herod was this puppet king that the Romans installed over the Jewish people. He forced Mary and Joseph to flee to the wilderness to find safety in Egypt as he hunted to kill Jesus. Herod can't get Jesus. The dragon can't get the child. Both are enraged. So the dragon chases the woman into the wilderness where God protects her. And Herod kills a bunch of babies. God sends Mary and Joseph into the wilderness where God protected them. Do you see the parallel stories here? A woman sent to the wilderness, protected in the wilderness. The view from below and the view from above. The dragon can't get the child or the woman. And what do villains do when they can't get the hero? They go after those they love. They go after her offspring, which is the church, which is Jesus' followers. The dragon or evil or however you want to conceive of this force has its proxies, its agents that do its bidding, who will meet next week. Behind this visible conflict is a darker spiritual reality. And John portrays it like a dragon-like figure, speaking in vivid symbols, an evil power animating Herod. Now, dragons, I don't know about you. I don't go to sleep worrying about dragons. For us, they're fantasy, Game of Thrones, Harry Potter. They're entertainment, but not for the ancients. They had a very different worldview. They believed the earth was flat. It rested on pillars. It was surrounded by water. And inhabiting those waters were evil monsters, dragons. Dragons were real for the ancients. They were dangerous. They were to be feared. Just like women fear strange men in the night, or men fear waxing, like it was fear. Science has brought us forward. Although you probably saw it too, a woman interviewed last week, legit believes the world is flat. She said it with a straight face and a convincing tone because she's done her research. And she's allowed to vote. It's pretty scary, and operate a motorized vehicle. But what God is showing John through this vision is that Herod wasn't working alone. Herod is acting on behalf of evil, on behalf of this dragon figure, as do any and all rulers, organizations, institutions, denominations, religions, you name it, who don't share God's dream for creation, who don't act on behalf of God, who don't care for what God cares for or for who God cares for. When they don't, they're acting on behalf of the dragon. As I said last week, Revelation is an urgent call to open our eyes. And while John uses imaginary images to represent evil, evil is not imaginary. I think we can all agree on that. This was a message to John's audience. The dragon has feet on earth, agents on earth, beasts that do its bidding. And this may sound really melodramatic, but this is the vision that John is trying to put into our minds to wake us up of what's actually going on behind what we see. Now, I'm not saying there's a demon behind every bush. People have taken that to a ridiculous extreme. Every stub toe is a demon or an evil force. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we can go the other extreme. But we're in a battle against these forces of evil. Your suffering isn't from God. Your illness, your accident, your loss, your grief, they're not from God. That is not how God works. And if anyone has ever told you God's got some glorious plan, it just requires your tragedy in order to carry it out, just reject that. Reject that. And look to Jesus and ask, is that something Jesus would do? Did Jesus ever harm anyone? Because if it doesn't ring true to Jesus, if it doesn't look like Jesus, it's not God. It's kind of like Jesus is our BS meter. We look to Jesus to discern, to discern what God is like, to discern what people tell us God is like, to discern whether the circumstances that we're experiencing are actually from God. John is imploring his audience, hold fast. God has already won. All will be well. And he said, they triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. Through the blood of their Lamb, the Lamb, through self-giving, self-sacrificial love. That's how they triumph. Trusting, even in the midst of their circumstances, God has won. And actually, this is how God wins. Even if it costs them their own lives. By the word of their testimony, as Christians that lived like Jesus, not just believed stuff about Jesus. John doesn't say they defeated evil by perfect doctrine. They didn't defeat evil by believing all the right things. We conquer evil by being the presence of Christ. And later John says, those who follow the Lamb wherever he goes defeat evil. But where is Jesus? Where does the Lamb go? Where do we find Jesus? Where did we find Jesus in the Gospels? With the vulnerable, with society's disposables, with the shamed, with the peacemakers, with the justice seekers, with the children. Jesus welcomed children when no one else did. With the sick and the imprisoned, those on the streets. Jesus in the manger. Jesus in the smelly places. Jesus on the cross. Jesus in the giving places. I'm going to invite Randy just to come up and create some space for us as we sit with this. I know it's a lot. I just want to end with a quote from Professor Richard Leisher of Duke Divinity School. He said this, I have seen the future and it belongs to God. And I would add, I have seen the present and with eyes of hope, it belongs to God. The future belongs to God, friends. John's message to the churches is, I have seen the future and it belongs to God. So hold fast, have hope. God has won, so we can follow the Lamb wherever the Lamb goes. And in fact, that is how God will win, as we follow the Lamb wherever he goes. So I wonder if we could just pause for a moment and ask yourself, where in your life, in your work, relationships, family, do you reach for the sword instead of the cross? Where do you lean into power rather than humility? If your concept of God isn't like Jesus, because I know for many of us, it isn't or wasn't, ask God to heal that, to replace that fearsome image with that of Jesus, the slaughtered lamb. Just pause for a moment. God, we ask that you'd open our eyes. Just give us the view from above. Give us discerning eyes and spirits to be able to see, to recognize those things that are not of you, that are not of Jesus. Our natural reactions, the way we've acculturated to our culture, the way we've adopted the ways of our culture. God, help us to see the way of the Lamb and give us the courage to follow you. Amen. I kind of overpromised and underdelivered. We didn't get to the beasts and the 666 today, but there was so much I had to cut. I want you to feel sorry for me. There's so much on the cutting room floor that I just couldn't get to. So we will do the beasts and the 666 next week. And next week's a barn burner. So I encourage you to tune in for that. Our prayer team's at the front. Again, they love to pray for you. There is no request, no hurt, no burden too small or too big. And everything you share with them is confidential. And if you want to know more about Jesus, if you want to know more about following this Lamb, please, please chat with me. I'll be in the atrium. Johanna will be there in the atrium, probably near the Celebrate Recovery table. And we just love to chat with you. And I just want to send us off with a blessing. It's the same one we've been using for the last few weeks, because it is my prayer as we trek through Revelation. This is my prayer for us. May the eyes of your heart be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy people, and his incomparably great power for us who believe. Go in power, friends. Go in the power of the slaughtered lamb. Go in peace. And we'll see you next week, if not before. Have a great day.
Thanks for spending time with us today. If this message was helpful to you, please consider passing it on, giving it a like, or supporting our work so we can continue to provide more great content. And if you're looking for a church to call home, whether in person or online, we'd love to connect. Head to lakesidechurch.ca to find out how you can get involved. Thanks again for being with us. We'll see you next time.